This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S. Republican presidential contenders hold a second debate. We'll have an analysis of who won, who lost, and what next in a moment. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon worries about Hungary's treatment of migrants.
I was shocked to see how these refugees and migrants were treated. It's not acceptable.
An accused U.S. Army deserter about to have his day in military court. Singer Whitney Houston performs again, but not really. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The second U.S. Republican presidential debate was held at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library Wednesday night near Los Angeles, a gathering of 11 candidates seeking the party's 2016 nomination, with an eager American public tuning in. Billionaire real estate developer Donald Trump came into the debate, leading in the polls over the other contenders, and much was expected from them to knock him around. With me is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. And Jim, what's your analysis of what the Republican hopefuls had to say about the frontrunner and other issues?
Well, Ray, there was a whole lot of knocking around going on in this debate, and it had a totally different dynamic than the first debate that Donald Trump effectively dominated and then used that to sort of rise in the polls quite dramatically. I think the outcome on this one is a little more mixed. Trump certainly held his own. He got into some spats with some of his rivals, including Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, Jeb Bush, the former Florida governor. They went at it a few times, including over the decision to go into Iraq during Bush's brother's reign, George W. Bush, the former president. There were some testy moments between Trump and Bush, between Trump and Carly Fiorina, the only woman who's in the Republican field right now. They're both coming from a business background. They were trying to go at each other about their business records. And what was interesting was someone we haven't heard much from lately, the New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, broke in there and said, you know, we're happy you guys had great careers and you did well, but for the average person out there, this is not what they're interested in. So there was some pushback, I think, tonight from some of the professional politicians. And I, you know, the outsiders, especially Donald Trump and Ben Carson, someone else we've seen come up in the polls, were not as prominent. Carly Fiorina, though, did make an impression on stage, and I think she'll be around for the next debate as well. So a mixed sort of feeling coming out of this debate. But I bet you a lot of the rivals of Donald Trump now feel better after this debate. They think they're in the game again.
Jim, did anyone make a mistake that could stick and perhaps drive them out of the campaign?
I didn't hear anything or see anything quite like that. I will wonder about Dr. Ben Carson, who's been trumpeted for rising in the polls right behind Donald Trump. He's a favorite of conservative Christian voters. He's billed himself as a political outsider. It seemed at times during the second debate he kind of got lost in the shuffle. He wasn't as forceful, didn't get as much time to speak. But that applies to a number of the other rivals, including people like Senator Rand Paul, Mike Huckabee, the former Arkansas governor. John Kasich had a strong debate at times. I think all of these contenders had moments where they were strong this evening, so nobody dominated. What does that mean for the race? Well, if Trump is not dominating as much as he was, I think this sort of jumbles the race a bit now, and I think everyone's going to feel the race is as wide open as it was before, and that maybe Trump is not got the kind of preeminent status he had before.
You mentioned Carly Fiorina, very articulate, and the only woman in the race. How do you think her performance tonight on the big stage will take her beyond?
She had some very strong moments. One in particular, talking about this issue we have in this country called Planned Parenthood, an organization that many Republicans oppose because they don't like abortion services. She gave a very impassioned plea on that, why Republicans should stand against the organization based on some recent controversial videos. So Carly Fiorina got some rounds of applause. She made a strong appearance. I think she'll be back. So the field that we see right now, there may be some others who may drop away over time, but right now I don't see anybody based on this debate feeling they have to leave the arena.
Well, what's next for the Republicans?
Well, they will have another monthly debate in October. And also, that's when the Democrats will start debating Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and the rest of the Democratic field next month. So between now and then, of course, the Republicans will try to build off their performances in this debate. And I would guess that most of them feel they have something to build on, and this race will continue to be intense.
Okay, thank you, Jim. That's VOA's national correspondent, Jim Malone. The first voting in the long process to picking presidential nominees in the United States is not scheduled until February 1st at caucuses in the Midwest state of Iowa. UN Chief Ban Ki-moon denounced Hungary's treatment of migrants as unacceptable Wednesday after police fired tear gas and sprayed water cannon at hundreds of asylum seekers on the country's border with Serbia.
I was shocked to see how these refugees and migrants were treated. It's not acceptable.
Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said the migrants were people fleeing war and persecution and that they must be treated with human dignity. Police clashed for several hours with the migrants after blocking one of the biggest entry points into the European Union. VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez spoke earlier from Munich with International Edition Susan Yaki about how EU nations are still struggling over strategies to deal with a huge influx of refugees.
The split is certainly deepening between Germany and other nations of Europe, particularly those in Eastern Europe, who are really not in agreement with Germany. Germany wants each country to accept 160,000 refugees per year. Some nations are saying, well, we don't have the economy or the infrastructure or the obligation to do so. Germany has threatened to push for EU sanctions against those countries that do not accept the quotas. That has prompted a very angry response from some nations, most notably Slovakia. Its leader this week said that Slovakia will never accept such a quota and that, in fact, such a measure will bring, in his words, the end of the EU.
Is this a pattern set in history somehow?
It is a pattern very much set in history, primarily, very recent history, within the decades after the Second World War. That was a time when the nations of Western Europe were rebuilding. They had issues of population decline, lack of manpower, and so they started inviting, in fact, workers, guest workers, they call them, from nations including Turkey. In the case of Great Britain, France, and the Netherlands, well, they drew from their former colonies. And so they have had time to assimilate and they've been conditioned to accept these migrants, whereas the nations of Eastern Europe do not have a history of accepting migrants. These were countries that lived under communist rule and where there was not the same level of development as there was in Western Europe. And so they are not as used to seeing migrants come in. Just to give you an example, there are only about 1% of the population of Hungary is foreign-born.
So what is the situation in the region today, Luis?
We continue to see a pretty substantial influx despite the border controls, despite actions by Hungary to seal its border to migrants coming in from Serbia. The police in Munich told me that the rate is at 1,800 migrants coming in through this city alone every day since Monday. And so that is a slower rate than we had seen in days previous. For example, over the weekend, that is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, there were 20,000 migrants coming through the Munich train station. What the German authorities are doing now is they are busing people to various parts of the country, doing everything they can to ensure that the migrants do not stay in Munich, do not linger here, and do not accumulate here as they had in days past. One of the reasons is that, we have another influx coming in, and that has to do with the upcoming Oktoberfest. That will last 2 weeks and will bring thousands of visitors to the city. Police being very careful, city authorities being very careful not to let the two groups mingle.
VOA's Luis Ramirez speaking from Munich with International Edition's Susan Yaki. Social media continues reacting to the refugee crisis. G. Abby Lee is here to tell us what some international organizations are saying. Hi, G.
Hi, Ray. One handle I want to highlight is that of the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's spokesperson. The handle is at UN_spokesperson, and that account live-tweeted his media briefing earlier Wednesday. Let me just highlight two tweets relating to the refugee crisis. Here's one. Hashtag UNSG Ban Ki-moon commends countries that are admirably doing all they can for the people in need. It tagged the UNHCR and UNOCA in the tweet. Another one reads like this. People fleeing war and persecution deserve real support, including asylum. Now, if you want to read the full transcript of the briefing, you can go to the UN homepage at un.org.
And speaking of media briefing, how are the global media outlets covering the situation?
Quite closely, and the one that I want to talk about has pretty graphic images of the refugee struggles. Russia's state-funded broadcaster RT's on Twitter at RT_COM. One tweet that's getting a lot of attention reads like this. Blood and tears. Chaotic scenes at Hungarian border as hashtag refugees come under tear gas. It also has a link to its YouTube page, and four photos are attached.
Can you tell us what they look like?
Absolutely. The first one is of a father holding a baby, and there's blood all over the father's face. There's also one in which a small boy is standing by himself and crying in the middle of a crowd. That tweet has been retweeted more than 350 times and marked as a favorite nearly 80 times. RT also sent out a breaking news tweet Wednesday, and it reads like this. Hungary detains 29 asylum seekers, including, quote, identified terrorist, unquote, in border clash. That tweet has been shared more than 300 times and marked as a favorite nearly 100 times. Ray?
Thank you, G. And you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who is facing charges of desertion, goes before an Army court hearing at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas, today. He was held for 5 years by the Taliban in Afghanistan before his release last year in exchange for five detainees held at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. As VOA's Greg Flakes reports from Houston, Bergdahl faces a separate charge that could get him life in prison.
At the hearing Thursday, Army prosecutors will begin laying out their case against Sergeant Bergdahl, focusing at first on the desertion charge. The panel hearing the arguments serves the same function as a grand jury in civilian criminal cases and will either recommend a court-martial or dismissal of charges. The other charge against Bergdahl of misbehavior before the enemy was used nearly 500 times during World War II, but has rarely been used since the war ended in 1945. Jeffrey Korn, a former Army attorney and current professor at South Texas College of Law in Houston, says the charge is appropriate in this case, given the evidence.
It hasn't been used much because there have not been many cases like this, where you have a soldier who apparently, from what we know from the evidence, abandoned his combat outpost, leaving his equipment behind, and put himself at best in a position where he was vulnerable to capture by the enemy.
Shortly after the Taliban released him in May of last year, soldiers who served with Bergdahl accused him of putting their lives at risk, and there was speculation that he had joined or had tried to join the enemy. Army investigators, however, found no evidence to back that accusation and cite evidence that Bergdahl was held captive and was beaten by his captors after he attempted to escape. Republicans criticized President Obama for making the deal, arguing that he had set free five men who could return to the fight against U.S. troops in return for a soldier who deserted his post. Another theme of those critical of the prisoner exchange is that Bergdahl's desertion resulted in death and injury to other soldiers trying to rescue him. While the desertion charge comes with a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison, Korn says the misbehavior before the enemy charge could result in a much harsher sentence.
If it's misbehavior before the enemy, it could be as much as life in prison. I don't think it'll be anything close to that. I think the main effort of the government sentencing argument will be a dishonorable discharge.
It's also possible that Army prosecutors and Bergdahl's lawyers will work out a plea bargain deal, whereby the soldier would relieve the military court of carrying out a long trial in exchange for a guilty plea and a moderate punishment. He could, for example, use his time in captivity to reduce whatever prison time is ordered. Bergdahl may also seek to protect his back pay and veterans benefits by accepting prison time rather than a dishonorable discharge. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
U.S. Vice President Joe Biden's national security advisor says that despite the best efforts of opponents to demonize the Iran nuclear deal, the U.S. is moving forward with the agreement. Republicans in Congress have staunchly opposed the agreement reached in July between Iran and a group that includes the U.S., Britain, China, France, Russia, and Germany. Lawmakers have 60 days to review the terms and either vote for or against the deal, but Republicans have so far failed in their bid to advance a resolution to reject it. Arms Control Association senior fellow Greg Thielman discussed his perspectives on the agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, with International Edition's Jeffrey Young.
Well, the first point I would make is that this agreement has done the most important thing for preventing an Iranian nuclear weapons capability. That is, it blocks off the pathways for Iran to actually develop a nuclear warhead to put on a missile that would threaten its neighbors or conceivably people beyond the Middle East. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. But beyond that, this agreement has more limits on delivery vehicles than was expected. Many people, certainly the Iranians, expected that this agreement would drop all of the UN Security Council resolution bans on ballistic missiles because it was basically about nuclear weapons and not about delivery vehicles. But the surprise was that it even extended the ballistic missile restrictions for another 8 years into the future. So this is really a major impediment to Iran making significant advances, even in their delivery systems. And when one looks at what Iran has been doing, Iran has not been working on its medium-range ballistic missiles that could reach Israel. And there's really no evidence at all that Iran has an active program to develop longer-range systems. What Iran is doing is basically trying to substitute for the fact that it has essentially no air force to have at least a modest deterrent in the Persian Gulf region against hostile forces in the Persian Gulf and against people on the other side of the Persian Gulf that are threatening Iran. So an awful lot of the rhetoric about Iranian ballistic missiles have been exaggerated in comments in Washington by politicians.
Having a workable missile to begin with, and number two, a warhead that would fit on the missile. And most warheads these days are in the 500 kilogram range. That's a pretty small miniaturization for a nuclear device, correct?
That's right. The United States, most other members of the international community trying to restrict nuclear weapons technology, use this 500-kilogram payload as a indication of what the size of a warhead would be that the U.S. has to protect against in terms of delivery vehicles. So the truth is that countries that are just developing nuclear weapons for the first time, particularly when they don't have access to a lot of nuclear weapons testing or design information, build very heavy and large nuclear warheads, and it takes a lot of work to miniaturize the warhead and put it on a missile that can achieve significant range.
That's Greg Thielman, Senior Fellow at the Arms Control Association, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Coming up, a new look at Whitney Houston. Gone, but not exactly. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? It's called a nano-injector, a tiny nano-device, 1/100th the size of a human hair. Brigham Young University scientists are using it to transfer genes and DNA to new cells. Nano-injection is a process that replaces micro-injection. Here's BYU's Sandra Burnett.
The micro-injection needle, it is large and it can damage the cell as it actually goes in.
Due to technological advances, Burnett says the two large needles have been replaced by much smaller needles called lances.
DNA is a negatively charged molecule. And so we could put a positive charge on the lance, and DNA will actually collect on the outside of it. And then we could put that lance into a cell and reverse the charge, and it drops DNA off there.
Burnett says this new technology will transform the gene therapy industry. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosshans.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. It's been more than 3 years since the late pop diva Whitney Houston died, but now people who never got the chance to see her in concert will have the opportunity to do just that, thanks to technology. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the holographic Whitney Houston concert planned for next year.
Shauna, this is going to be a hologram of Whitney Houston that's going to be in concert. Explain that.
Okay. Well, in 2016, Whitney Houston, the hologram, will be making an appearance somewhere in the U.S. And so this will be a visual representation of Whitney in concert. So it will include this hologram singing. It'll include choreography, as it were. Whitney was not a very well-known dancer. It will, as you say, give folks the opportunity who've never seen her before to do so. And then also give those of us who have had the opportunity to see her and loved her a chance to experience Whitney Houston as we did in concert. But then also in other ways, because they're going to expand this beyond just her performing and include other elements as well.
Now, this has got the approval of the Houston estate. This is not just something somebody cooked up. The people who are actually in charge of her estate have approved this, right?
Yes, and it's taken a couple of years. They were approached, Pat Houston and Sissy Houston, her mom, were approached with this idea a couple of years ago, but it was still very fresh, her death. And they weren't certain that it would be the best thing and that it might be a little insensitive. But now they have agreed. And so we know that 2016, a group called Hologram USA will be the ones to create this. And what I think is interesting is that they're going to do one concert in the U.S. It'll be broadcast online. And then beyond that, there'll be like a year-long residency, and then they'll take it internationally. So Whitney will be going on a world tour, if you will.
And this is not the first time that this kind of thing has been attempted, right? There was one with Snoop Dogg and Tupac, and a couple of other artists have done this too?
Absolutely. In fact, this company, Hologram USA, they've done Buddy Holly, they've done Roy Orbison, they've done Liberace, Patsy Cline. So they've done some pretty high-level celebrities in the past. And my understanding is they've done them justice, which is why the Houston estate agreed to work with this company in particular.
It doesn't look kind of like ghosty like you would imagine. It actually looks like the person is really there. It's not like you can see through them or something.
Yeah, but it's very interesting. They did one of Michael Jackson not too long ago, and again, it was fairly soon after his death, and it brings up really interesting emotions because on one hand, it's exciting to see them again, but then on the other hand, you know that it's not them in real life; they're gone, and it just. This is 2016 technology. What can you say?
Well, if you have any comment about this, please let Shauna know. You can hit her up on Twitter. She is at VOA Lady DJ. You can also send a tweet to at VOA underscore music. You can listen for her show, The Soul Lounge, on our website, voanews.com.
The International Olympic Committee announced five finalists to host the 2024 Summer Olympic Games. Four European cities are on the list: Budapest, Hamburg, Paris, and Rome. The fifth candidate is the U.S. West Coast city of Los Angeles. The final decision will be made in 2017. That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, information, and videos on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Russia is expanding its military support for the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, whom it has supported throughout a brutal conflict that has taken the lives of over 250,000 people. Secretary of State John Kerry called Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on September 15th, expressing the United States' concern that a Russian military buildup in Syria could further escalate the conflict, lead to a greater loss of innocent life, increase refugee flows, and risk confrontation with the anti-ISIL coalition operating in Syria. Russia claims its military support for Assad is aimed at defeating terrorists like ISIL. President Barack Obama said September 11th that Russia and the United States' common view of the ISIL threat creates a potentially converging interest. But, said President Obama, the bad news is that Russia continues to believe that Assad is somebody that is worthy of continuing support.
It has been my view and the view of the United States government that as long as Assad is there, he has alienated so much of the Syrian population that it will not be possible to arrive at a peaceful ceasefire and political settlement. And you'll continue to have this vacuum that's filled by extremists.
President Obama said, "You can't continue to double down on a strategy that's doomed to failure." If, however, the Russians are willing to work with us and the 60-nation coalition we've put together, then there's the possibility of a political settlement in which Assad would be transitioned out, and a new coalition of moderate, secular, and inclusive forces could come together and restore order in the country. That, said President Obama, is our goal.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.